This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Psychoanalysis and Spiritual Psychology. This is lecture 4 of 5 lectures, entitled Hidden Depths of Soul. Given on February 27th, Steiner's birthday, or actually his name day, 1912. We have recently begun talking about the existence of hidden soul depths, and it will be good to continue to occupy ourselves with various details of this subject that may be useful for students of spiritual science. Generally speaking, it must be said that a complete explanation and understanding of these things can be worked out only on the basis of what spiritual science gives us. We have considered the human organization from various viewpoints. Therefore, you will easily be able to connect, in the right way, what appears when we look into the hidden depths of the soul with the human organization as we know it, from the more or less elementary presentations based on the worldview of spiritual science. It has been repeatedly said that everything in our mental images and perceptions, our impulses of will, our feelings, in short, all that goes on in our souls in the normal condition between waking up and falling asleep, may be called the activities, characteristics, and powers of our ordinary consciousness. Now we will represent in a diagram everything that is part of this ordinary consciousness, everything we know and feel and will between waking up and falling asleep, by enclosing it between these two parallel lines, and there's a drawing. In this section, AB, belongs our imagination, as well as every kind of perception. When we establish contact with the outer world, and are in touch with it through our senses, and thus get a picture of this world through all kinds of connected sensory impressions, then that is also part of our ordinary consciousness. And all our feelings and impulses of will belong to it as well. In short, everything contained in our ordinary consciousness. One could say that everything our normal soul activities tell us about in our everyday life belongs in the area defined by these parallel lines. And let me just describe this. It's a 2x6 array, and let's just say the top row is on left to right, reading 3 sections. Creative physical world, to the right of that, sense organs, nervous system, to the right of that, mental images, perceptions, feelings, impulses of will. Now going down to the second row, left to right, we have elemental world. To the right of that, heat forces of the blood, breathing forces. To the right of that, hidden aspects of soul life, unconscious, imagination, inspiration, intuition, premonitions, second sight. End of diagram. Back to the reading. One could say that everything our normal soul activities tell us about in our everyday life belongs in the area defined by these parallel lines. The point is for us to know with certainty that this so-called soul life depends on using the physical body as its instrument, including the senses and the nervous system. If we contrast these parallel lines with two others, we can say that our sense organs and nervous system are the tools or instruments for this consciousness, and the sense organs probably to a greater extent than the nervous system. Beneath the threshold of this ordinary consciousness lies everything we can enclose between other parallel lines and can describe as the hidden sides of our soul life or as the unconscious. We get a good idea of what is embedded in this subconscious layer if we remember that through spiritual training, human beings can develop imagination, inspiration, and intuition. Just as we must place mental images, feelings, and impulses of will in the ordinary consciousness, so we have to locate imagination, inspiration, and intuition in the subconscious. As we know, the subconscious becomes active, not only as a result of spiritual training, but also as a legacy of a primeval, primitive state of consciousness, that is, as an atavism. In that case, there appear what we call visions, and these visions of this naive, primitive consciousness correspond to the imaginations achieved through training. Premonitions appear also, and they are the primitive equivalent of inspiration. We will immediately see from a significant example what the difference is between an inspiration and a premonition. We have already mentioned that in the course of the 20th century, there will occur in human evolution what may be called a sort of spiritual return of Christ. There will be a number of persons who will experience, in an etheric form, this working of Christ from the astral plane into our world. We can find out about this fact by learning, through careful training, what the course of evolution is, and by realizing, as a result of this schooling, that this event must happen in the 20th century, as described. However, it can also happen, as it often does at the present time, that here and there individuals are gifted with a natural, primitive clairvoyance, and then have a kind of obscure inspiration, which we may call a premonition of the approach of Christ. Perhaps such people do not know exactly what is involved, yet even so important an inspiration as this can indeed appear in the form of a premonition if something occurs in the primitive consciousness that is more than a mere premonition or vision. The vision consists in putting some sort of picture in the place of a spiritual process. Let us say, for example, that someone has lost a friend whose eye has passed through the gate of death, I capital. This friend now dwells in the spiritual world, and a kind of bond establishes itself between the deceased and the one still living in this world. It is possible that the latter cannot rightly understand what the deceased wants from him, and has a false idea of what his dead friend experiences. The connection between them presents itself in a vision that, as a picture, may be false, though founded upon the fact that the dead one is indeed trying to establish a bond with a living person. This manifests itself as a premonition, so that the living person, having premonitions, knows certain things, either concerning the past or the future, that are inaccessible to normal consciousness. When the human soul, however, has a clear perception, not just a vision, which may possibly be false, but a distinct perception of an occurrence, let us say, in the sense world, but in this case in a sphere invisible to the physical senses, or of an incident in the supersensible world, then this is called deuteroscopy, spelled deuteroscopy, deuteroscopy, like Deuteronomy, only deuteroscopy, or second sight in occultism. With all this, I have described to you only what takes place in the human soul, albeit only in the subconscious, whether it has been achieved through proper training or appears as natural clairvoyance. As to the difference between the unconscious and our ordinary consciousness, what goes on here in the human soul itself is very different from the processes in the ordinary consciousness. The relationship between the processes of our ordinary consciousness and everything they are concerned with is really such that people have spoken of the impotence of ordinary consciousness. The eyes see a rose, but regardless of our perceptions and ideas about roses, the eyes, which are so constituted that the image of the rose arises in our consciousness, have no power over the blooming, growth, and withering of the rose. The rose grows and withers because of the forces of nature. However, our eyes cannot perceive anything but the immediate present, as long as only our ordinary consciousness is at work. This is not true for the facts and events in our subconscious. And this is what we must keep in mind, for it is extremely important. When we perceive something with our eyes, in the normal process of seeing, for example, colors or anything else, we cannot alter the objective facts in any way by mere perception. In fact, if nothing else happens to our eyes, they also remain unchanged by the mere act of seeing. It is only when we go beyond normal light to blinding light that we injure our eyes. Thus we can say that if we limit ourselves to the contents of normal consciousness. We do not even have any effect on ourselves. Our organism is so constituted that the processes of ordinary consciousness usually do not cause changes in us. It is quite different with what appears in the unconscious. Let us assume that we are forming an imagination, or have a vision, let's say, of a good being. This good being, then, is not in the physical, but in the supersensible world. Now, let us place the world of these beings that we perceive in an imagination or vision between these lines. And that's the lower horizontal row in the prior diagram. In that world, we have to seek all the perceptions and objects of our unconscious. I do not want to write anything in this space yet. Now, when we picture an evil or demonic being from this world in an imagination or vision, then we are not as powerless in regard to this being as our eyes are over the rose. When we have an imagination or vision of an evil being and develop for this completely clear visionary imagination a feeling that the being should depart, the latter must of necessity feel itself powerfully pushed or thrust away from us. The same principle applies when we have an imagination or vision of a good being. If we develop a sympathetic feeling, the good being feels impelled to approach us and to connect itself with us. All beings of this world feel our attracting or repelling forces when we form visions of them. Thus our eyes would be in the same position as our subconscious if they would not only see a rose, but could also, through seeing it, develop the desire that the rose approach and actually draw it to them. Or if your eyes, on seeing something disgusting, would not only conclude that it is disgusting, but would also be able to make the disgusting thing go away, merely through their antipathy, the eye's antipathy. The subconscious is in touch with the world where the sympathy and antipathy in the human soul have an effect. It is necessary to bring this before our souls. Sympathy and antipathy and all other subconscious impulses affect this world in the way described, as well as everything within us, everything that is part of our etheric body, and not only that, but even certain forces of the physical body, all of which we have to picture enclosed by these parallel lines. For we have to picture enclosed here everything that lives in us as the forces that pulsate through our blood, that is, its heat forces, as well as another force that lies in our healthy or unhealthy breathing, which is more or less determined by our whole organism. In other words, the condition of our breathing forces. Again, reference to the diagram. In addition, our subconscious also works on a large part of what we have to call our etheric body. The subconscious or hidden soul powers work within us and affect the heat forces of our blood. These in turn determine our pulse rate, the vitality or sluggishness of our blood circulation. And so you see, our subconscious is necessarily connected with our blood circulation. Whether somebody has a quicker or more sluggish circulation depends essentially on the forces of the person's subconscious. The demonic or good beings in the world out there can only be influenced when we have visions or imaginations or other perceptions of a certain clarity in our subconscious, that is, when we see them standing before us. It is only then that sympathy or antipathy evoke certain forces, as though by magic, and these forces then become active in that world. However, in terms of the influence on our own inner organism, consisting of what we have written down here in that drawing, it is not necessary that we have such clear pictures before our soul in our subconscious. Whether we know which imaginations correspond to a particular sympathy or not, the sympathy will affect our blood circulation, our breathing system, and our etheric body. Let us assume a person has prevailing sensations of nausea for a certain time. If this person were a visionary or had imaginative sight, he or she would see these visions and imaginations that are really perceptions of his or her own being, as I described the day before yesterday. They would be projected into space, but would, nevertheless, belong to the person's own inner world. These visions and imaginations would represent the force of the nausea living in him or her. Yet, even if the person could not practice this kind of self-knowledge and simply had nausea, it would live and work on him or her. The sensations of nausea would influence the heat forces of the blood and the person's forces of breathing. Thus it is indeed true that we have more or less healthy breathing and a more or less healthy blood circulation, depending on whether we experience this or that in our subconscious. The activity of the etheric body with all its processes is especially dependent on the world of feelings living in us. However, as becomes clear when the contents of the unconscious mind are really experienced by the soul, not only is there such a connection, but its existence exerts a continuous influence on the general condition of the human being. In other words, certain feelings and emotions enter into the unconscious, where they cause certain conditions of the heat forces of the blood, of the breathing power, and of the etheric body, and thus are beneficial to the organism or inhibit the individual's whole life. As a result of what enters into the subconscious, then, something in the person is always in the process of coming into being or dying away. So what we send from our conscious mind down into the subconscious, we are either depriving ourselves of our life forces or adding to them. For example, if we take pleasure in a lie we have told, if we are not horrified at it, which would be the normal feeling about lies, but instead are indulgent or even feel satisfaction, then the feelings we have added to the lie are sent down into the subconscious. This then impairs the circulation, breathing, and the forces of the etheric body. As a result, in regard to everything we retain after going through the portal of death, we will have become stunted and will have deprived ourselves of forces. Something will have died in us that would have lived if we had felt the normal loathing and disgust for the lie. Then these feelings of loathing at the lie would have descended and would have affected the forces we have indicated here, and we would have sent something beneficial, namely creative forces, into our organism. We see that we are indeed working on our coming into being and dying away out of our subconscious, because it continuously receives forces from our upper or ordinary consciousness. In their present condition, human beings are not yet powerful enough to corrupt through their soul activity other parts of their organism besides the blood circulation, the breathing, and the etheric body. They cannot impair the coarser and more solid parts of the physical organism. They can corrupt, so to speak, only a part of their organism. We can see especially clearly what has been impaired when what remains of the etheric body, which is in constant interaction with the heat forces of the blood and the condition of our breathing, has been influenced in this way. Then it atrophies because of bad feelings. By the same token, it receives stimulating, strengthening, and beneficial forces through good, normal, and sincere feelings. We can say, therefore, that through the processes in their subconscious, human beings work directly on the growth and dying away, that is, on the real processes, the reality of their organism. They descend from the region of powerlessness in the ordinary consciousness to a region where something comes into being and dies away in their own soul, and consequently in their entire organism. We have seen that because the subconscious can more or less be experienced by the soul, something may be known about it, and it also exerts an influence on a world sphere we can designate, with an expression used throughout the Middle Ages, the elemental world. We cannot enter directly into a relationship with this elemental world. We can do so only indirectly, by having those experiences within us that result from the influence of the subconscious on the organism. After some time, when we have come to know ourselves so well that we can say, if we feel this and send down this or that feeling resulting from our conduct into our subconscious, we destroy certain things or cripple them. But if we have other experiences and send down different feelings, we do something beneficial for ourselves. In short, when we experience this ebb and flow of destructive and beneficent forces in us for a time, then we will become more and more mature in our self-knowledge. That is what true self-knowledge really is. This can be explained only by analogy. The self-knowledge we gain in this way is as though a scorpion were biting off one of our toes every time we lie or do not have the proper feelings about a lie arising within us. No doubt if people felt such a real effect in their lies, they would not lie as much as they now do. A crippling of our organism in the physical world can be compared with what really happens, though we usually do not perceive it, through those daily experiences we send down to the subconscious mind. What is sent down because of our tolerant attitude toward a lie is such that it does bite off something and take it away from us, and the loss stunts us. In our future karma, we must then regain what we lost. If we send down a right feeling into the subconscious mind, there is naturally an almost endless scale of feelings that may descend. We grow and create new life forces in our organism. Observing our own coming into being and dying away is the first stage of true self-knowledge. People have told me that in the last lecture they did not fully understand how to distinguish between a genuine vision or imagination belonging to the realm of the objective and something that appears out there in space but really belongs to our own subjective nature. Well, I cannot tell you to write down this or that rule, and then you will be able to make the distinction. There are no such rules. One learns this gradually in the course of development, and we will be able to correctly distinguish between what belongs to us and what is an outer vision and belongs to a real being only after we have first endured the experience of having deadly subconscious processes continuously eating away at us. Then we are equipped with a kind of certainty. Then we also reach the state where we can confront a vision or imagination and know that we can penetrate it with the power of our spiritual sight. If the vision persists when this active force of seeing is turned upon it, then it is an objective fact. If the active force of our spiritual sight extinguishes the vision, it was obviously only our own creation. People who are not careful to do this may be looking at thousands and thousands of pictures from the Akashic record, but they do not test them to see whether or not they will be extinguished by a resolutely active gaze. They will see the Akashic pictures, which can tell us so much, only as images of their own inner life. It could happen, it is not likely, but it could happen, that somebody sees nothing but his or her own inner life, projected into dramatic pictures, and extended throughout the entire Atlantean world, throughout generations of human evolution. In spite of their apparent objectivity, these pictures may be nothing else but the projection of the individual's own inner self. When we have passed through the portal of death, the obstructions no longer exist through which something subjective within us becomes an objective vision or imagination. In our everyday life nowadays, what we experience in our subconscious, what we send into our subconscious, does not always become a vision or imagination. It becomes an imagination through proper training, a vision in the case of atavistic clairvoyance. As soon as we have passed through the gate of death, all our inner life becomes at once an objective world. It is simply there. Essentially, Kamaloka is nothing else but a world built up around us out of what we experience in our own soul. This condition is reversed only in Devakan. Thus we can easily understand what I have said about the effect of the sympathy or antipathy in visions, imaginations, inspirations, premonitions, and so on. In any case, they influence the objective elemental world. I said about this effect that as long as human beings are incarnated physically, only what they have developed into vision or imagination affects this elemental world. In the case of the dead, however, the forces that were present in the subconscious and are taken along when we pass through the portal of death affect the elemental world. Thus everything we experience after death, in fact, influences the elemental world. As surely as waves in a river spread, so do the experiences of the dead spread in the elemental world. Therefore the elemental world is constantly filled with what is aroused in it by the content of the subconscious mind we bring with us through the gate of death. What matters, therefore, is to be able to bring about the conditions allowing us to see and perceive things in the elemental world. It need not surprise us that clairvoyants can recognize events in the elemental world correctly as effects of the dead. It is even possible, as you will see, to trace the effects of these experiences of the dead, which at first appear in the elemental world, all the way to the physical world, of course only under certain conditions. When clairvoyants have gone through everything I have described and have reached the point of perceiving the elemental world, then after a certain time they will be able to have strange experiences. Let us suppose a clairvoyant looks at a rose with his physical eyes and receives a sense impression. Let us further suppose that he has trained himself to develop a certain nuance of feeling when seeing the color red. This is necessary, for without it the process can go no further. Unless colors and sounds produce definite nuances of feeling, this clairvoyance, directed at outer objects, cannot proceed further. Suppose the clairvoyant puts the rose away. If he were not clairvoyant, what he has felt would sink into his subconscious and would be working there, making him either healthy or ill. But since he is clairvoyant, he perceives how the imagination of the rose works in his subconscious. That is to say, he has a visionary picture, an imagination of a rose. At the same time, he perceives how his feelings about the rose affect his etheric or even his physical body, either in a beneficial or a destructive way. He can observe the effect of all this on his own organism. When he has this imagination before him, he will be able, therefore, to exert an attraction on the being we may call the group soul of the rose, which underlies the existence of the rose. The clairvoyant will be looking into the elemental world and see the group soul of the rose in so far as it dwells there. If the clairvoyant continues, having started with looking at the rose, then given it away and traced the inner process of concentrating totally on the rose and the effects of that, and has finally seen something of the rose in the elemental world, then he sees in the place where the rose once appeared to him a kind of wonderfully shining picture that is part of the elemental world. And now at this point in the process something happens. The clairvoyant can now disregard what is before him. He can command himself not to look with his inner sight at what seems to be a living, etheric being going out into the world. Then a strange thing happens. Namely, the clairvoyant sees something that passes through his eyes and shows him how the forces work that proceed from the etheric body and build up the eyes. The clairvoyant sees forces that belong to the formative forces of his own physical body. He sees his own physical eyes as he ordinarily sees an external object. That can indeed happen. One can follow the path from the outer object to the point where one sees in a spiritual picture in absolute darkness, no other sense impression must be allowed, what our eyes look like. In other words, we can see our own inner organs. We have then entered the region that is really forming and creating in the physical world, the creative physical world. We first perceive it when we become aware of our own physical organization. Thus, in a sense, we have come back, full circle, to ourselves. What sent such forces into our eyes, that we see them as sending out rays of light, which really correspond to the essential nature of seeing? Then we see our eyes surrounded by a sort of yellow glow. We see them enclosed within us. This was brought about by the development of the forces that brought humanity to this point. The forces proceeding from a dead person follow the same course. The dead take with them the contents of their subconscious into the world they inhabit after passing through the gate of death. Just as we can get inside, so to speak, our own physical eyes, so the forces sent out by the dead in the elemental world return to the physical world. The dead may have a special longing for a person they have left behind. This longing is at first only in the subconscious, but it soon becomes a living vision, and as such affects the elemental world. What is only a vision in the physical world becomes at the same time also a power in the elemental world. This power follows the path indicated by the longing for the one who is living, and if the conditions permit, they cause rumblings and disturbances in the physical world near the living person. The latter may hear rumbling or crashing sounds or something like that, and they are heard just like any physical sounds. Such things occurring in this connection would be noticed by many more people than they are now if people paid attention to the times most favorable to such occurrences. The best times for such observations are those of falling asleep and waking up. Generally, people do not pay attention to these things. Nevertheless, there is hardly anybody who has never perceived any signs and manifestations from the supersensible world, ranging all the way from rumbling noises to words, in the transition periods of falling asleep and waking up. I have wanted to speak about all this today, my dear friends, to show you the reality and nature of the connection between human beings and the world. The impressions of an objective, sensory world we have in our ordinary consciousness are powerless. They are as though without any real connection to that world. But as soon as what we experience descends into the subconscious, the connection to realities is established. The powerlessness of the ordinary consciousness turns into a delicate magic. When we have passed through the gate of death and are released from the physical body, our experiences are such that they are effective in the elemental world, and under favorable circumstances, even on the physical plane, where they may then be observed by the ordinary consciousness. I have described the simplest case to you, because one has to begin there, certainly in the course of time, and we have always taken our time gradually to work out for ourselves what we needed to know. We will move on to more complicated matters that can lead us into the more intimate connections between the world and human beings. The end of Lecture 4.